Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Jason Glass is Kentucky's new Commissioner of Education. Glass went to the University of Kentucky, where he earned a bachelor's degree in political science and history, a master's in political science, and a master's in education. While a graduate student there, he already was serving as an instructor at UK as well as at Georgetown College. He also taught high school social studies for Hazard Independent Schools. Dr. Glass received his Ph.D. in education leadership from Seton Hall University, and he also holds a certificate in advanced education leadership from Harvard. In 2016, President Barack Obama nominated him to the National Board for Education Sciences. Dr. Glass was hired in late July and returns to Kentucky from Colorado, where he served as superintendent of Eagle County Public Schools and then of Jeffco Public Schools in Metro Denver. Thanks for joining us, Commissioner Glass.
Thank you, Tom. I'm delighted to talk about education with you.
And my first question is, what is it like to step into this critical and always very intense leadership role in such intense times, a pandemic going on, economic hardship as a result, and civil unrest as well?
Well, it's an extraordinary time in our nation and in the state of Kentucky, and it's an extraordinary and challenging time for any school leader. But I think people in public education are called to serve. That's one of the big drives that everyone working in public education has. And so it's also an opportunity to do good and to serve our communities and the Commonwealth. I'm still working in Jeffco Public Schools. I'll be here until September, working on making sure that this district restarts school in the fall safely and in a way that looks after the interests of our kids and our families. And at the same time, I'm working to get up to speed on the context in Kentucky and thinking about all of the issues that you raised with COVID-19 reopening, the economic impact from that, anti-racism and equity work that's really important in the state that needs to be done. And then longer range thinking about how we can transform and change the education system in the Commonwealth so that we are really preparing our kids for a globally interconnected and lightning fast world and economy.
I can't imagine what your plate must look like right now. That's an awful lot.
It's a busy time, but it's an energizing time. All hands are on deck, and I can tell you that just in my time working with the department staff at the Kentucky Department of Education, they are committed and engaged. I've also had numerous conversations and exchanges with educators in the state. They are engaged and working really hard to find answers to these really tough questions. We have a set of problems for which there really is no clear set of best practices or solutions that don't have a significant downside. So you've got to work the best you can to make a good decision and then handle the problems that are associated with that decision. So that's the space that we're in right now. And it's a difficult space, and there are lots of opinions and thoughts about what we should or shouldn't do. I think we've got to work hard to depoliticize the conversation, particularly around the COVID-19 reopening. Think about what's in the best interest of our students and how do we keep our kids and our staff and our community safe. That's a narrow needle to thread, but that is the work that school leaders are doing right now.
Okay, let's dig into that a little bit. And considering the current reality brought on by the pandemic and the abrupt way the school year had to end this past spring, how will you work with school districts and with educators to build confidence among them and among parents that we can reduce the risk while also providing a high-quality academic program?
Well, that's exactly what we have to do, is do both of those things. We had to shift to remote learning this past spring. It was really the only option that we had. And while we should all be proud of the way educators in Kentucky and really all over the country responded to that by standing up these remote learning, NTI, non-traditional instruction, online learning options very quickly, We also know that it's not a complete substitute for the in-person connection. And we had 6 months of in-person learning and relationships built on those experiences to build upon when we transition to the remote or the online environment. We're not going to have that at the beginning of the year. Those relationships are not there, or they're not as strong as they once were. So I think that's going to present an additional challenge. We may see schools open in remote settings because there's a lot of logistical changes, including symptom screening and the way buildings are configured and how kids move through them, massive scheduling changes and staffing allocation changes, changes to ventilation systems. There's equipment to procure and get in place. There's just a slew of really difficult decisions to put in place that I think are leading school districts to start opening under a remote context or delaying opening altogether so they can get all that done. But I do believe that we've got to work towards some kind of in-person experience, even if that's a couple of days a week. And we put with that every virus mitigation strategy that science brings to us and says this is effective. We have seen international systems do that. Most of them have been in countries where virus counts in the community have been suppressed. So that's something that we've got to work on in Kentucky and around this country. We all have a part to play in helping get our schools open.
We've been hearing concerns from teachers and from parents and others about the impact of social distancing, of masking, of remote learning, and how that might impact the development of children on social and emotional levels. And I just wondered, if do you foresee the possibility of an increased need for a focus on social emotional learning, for example?
I do. I see it with my own kids when we talk about, I have a 7-year-old and an 8-year-old, and when we talk about them moving to Kentucky, they're excited about that because it's the place where their grandparents and their family is. And then when we talk about school and the possibility that they won't be going back to school, I can see that they're heartbroken over that. So I see that devastation, that trauma in my own kids. I know families everywhere feel that too. They know that their kids need that that social interaction and development. And we saw greater instances of suicidal ideation and depression this past spring when we had all remote, all online settings. And so that's something that schools have got to plan for as well. In addition to all the things that we have to think about and manage, we also should expect students to be disconnected, disengaged, to have struggled with isolation, to have struggled with fear and a sense of hopelessness and doom. These are all real feelings that our kids are having, and that we've got to support them through that. And I think the best solution to that, or one of the best solutions to that, is to offer hope for a better future. And I know that's sort of a cliched and hollow phrase, but I believe that it is the case that there will come a day when this virus doesn't rule all of our lives. And that may be months away if we work really hard toward that. So we've got to keep in mind that all of these things that we're having to do right now are temporary, and we are going to get through this.
It's looking now as though the norm is going to be remote learning, at least initially this fall. And I'm wondering about equity and how you'll work across the Commonwealth to ensure that all students, no matter their gender, their race, their religion, their income level, where they live, zip code, that all have equitable access to high-speed internet and the computers that they need so they can actually work online remotely.
Well, that's a challenging problem, but it's also sort of a technical problem in that if you had enough money and devices and fiber systems, you could solve the problem. Our challenge is really in the timing of this and how much of that infrastructure we had in place before. So I think we've got to look at what capacity did schools and communities have, how many devices can they deploy either through a school or donation efforts where we make sure that every kid really has a connection or really has a device to work off of. And then what capacity exists in the community around high-speed internet access, or how that could be acquired at low cost or no cost. We can also look at community centers where we could open up spaces with social distancing where students and families can come in and work in those spaces and be connected. I've also seen success with using wireless hotspots, other mobile devices as a way of providing access. That's a more expensive option than some of the others that I found. But I think you have to consider what's the context of the community, what capacity they have, what challenges do they have, and then work the problem. Where you're identifying students who are not engaging, who we're not hearing from, finding out the reason why, and then working to solve that for them. I think over the long term, we've got to work to create some kind of in-person connection. And there are, I think, some ways to do that. Even in an all-remote experience, there's some good ideas emerging around how we can use schools as sort of community centers where people can come in. They're symptom screened where they come in. There's the ventilation system is running to turn over the air, and people are spaced out within that. But there's an opportunity to see somebody, to connect with somebody, to get the supports that they may need around medical care, mental health, food services. So I'm encouraged by that, and I think that our communities in the Commonwealth are going to rise to this challenge, just like we saw happen this past spring.
So lots and lots of variables, and the virus itself has been unpredictable, and there's no reason to think that those surprises have come to an end. And so I'm just wondering, does this mean that there needs to be a lot of contingency plans on the table?
Well, I think anyone who believes that they can predict what's going to happen with this virus next month or next week is vastly overstating their predictive power. We should prepare for things to keep changing and expect a dynamic environment. And so you have to develop contingency plans. If this happens, then we will take this action. If that happens, then we will take that action. And so school leaders have to be thinking about that. And we have to be preparing our staff, our kids, and our community for that. That's one of the frustrations, is that things keep moving around. And there's really no solution for that. So we can't soothe the concerns of our community and our kids and our constituents by saying that anybody knows exactly what's going to happen. You have to tell them the truth and tell them to expect conditions to keep emerging. We're all going to have to be adaptive and flexible and shift ourselves to meet the circumstances that we end up in.
Another major impact of COVID-19 is its impact on state revenue. Their revenues are really down. That's obviously going to mean that state funding of public education in Kentucky is likely to decrease. What are your thoughts on the additional burden that that will place on local support for education, especially in property-poor rural districts across the state?
Well, it's going to be very challenging, and there really isn't a good solution for it. If the economy suffers and tax collections suffer, public education is a big part of state expenditures, the largest part of any state's expenditure, so it's going to suffer to some degree as well. I think the legislature and the governor have to think about what can they do to prioritize and protect public education to the extent they can. I think we saw this spring just how important public schools are to communities by the absence of having an open public school and how disruptive that was to families and communities. We know now more than ever the worth of public schools and the value of public schools. So step one for those tough decisions that the legislature and the governor are going to have to make is thinking about how they can prioritize. With that said, they're probably not going to be able to shield public education completely from what may be catastrophic funding losses. So in that case, we're going to have to work with our schools around the state to effectively help them shrink the size of their organization so that they can continue to deliver the essential services, but there are probably going to be some things that they're going to have to stop doing, or structural things, structural changes to school, some services that we expected and that we're used to that are going to have to go away. But I think we also, again, have to remember that this is temporary. This does not dictate what the future past COVID-19 and past the economic impact of it is going to be. This is about surviving a tough time, continuing to deliver quality services to our kids, and really getting serious about what's essential, what's most crucial for our kids, putting our expenditures around those, and then hunkering down to survive until we get to a better place. And I believe I I firmly believe that we are going to get to a better place. You don't keep Kentuckians down. You don't keep Americans down. We'll get through this.
Jason Glass, he is Kentucky's new Commissioner of Education. We thank you for joining us, Dr. Glass.
Thank you, Tom.
You may have heard Jason Glass, the new state education commissioner, mention NTI, non-traditional instruction. Well, you're going to be hearing a lot more about NTI as the school year gets underway. The state has lifted the 10-day limit for NTI days. And it's front and center in this latest in our series on how teachers are preparing for the start of classes under the unpredictable conditions of a pandemic. Here's series host Cynthia Reeser.
I'm here today with Holly Robinson, and Holly is a high school social studies teacher at Rockcastle County High School in the Rockcastle County Public Schools. Holly, by now we've all heard the acronym NTI, non-traditional instruction, and of course that's the lessons that take place at home during snow days in a regular year, but this year, of course, we closed on March 13th. But in your district, Rockcastle County, you'd already chosen not to participate in this option provided by the Kentucky Department of Education. Why did Rockcastle County not use the NTI instruction before?
Well, we're a very rural district. We have areas in our county that even if you could afford to have broadband, you can't get it. So we decided as a district, and our superintendent, David Pencil, he chose a little bit more of a difficult route. We just make up all of our days and always have because he was concerned that students wouldn't get good instruction because of some of the economic and technology hindrances. So we've always done that, but with everything that's been going on, we kind of had to shift gears really quick. And so things with NTR are moving along very rapidly in our county. We had to scramble when everything shut down, but we got back up on our feet, and now we're headed towards having NTI. So we will be doing that as a permanent part of our curriculum.
So in March, I understand that you had to create these assignments from scratch. Describe a little bit about how teachers created those and how schoolwork looked different than it would have if the students had been coming to the classroom.
Well, we had a team of teachers at the high school from all of the core areas, and we did it extremely simple. As I said, there are many students in our district that don't have computers, don't have phones, don't have broadband. We have some that don't even have a landline. So we had to accommodate for that, and because we couldn't get them out that technology, and we also, you know, couldn't get them access to books and things like that, we had to make the NTI extremely simple. So we started off by sending everyone out some NTI instruction, and it was basic. And we were told that we had to come up with things that kids could do on their own without books, without media, without, you know, anything. So we did that, and we sent out the first round. And then after that, all of our teachers were calling their homeroom students, calling home to each student every week and communicating with them and finding out who had internet, you know, who could get online to get materials. And so we kind of, that's how we started to sort things out.
And I think you said that when you began, you had to mail those things. So you wanted everything to fit on one page?
Yes, we had a lot of envelope stuffing going on at central office. They mailed NTI work to each student, and that was just to get them started because we didn't want them to lag, you know, too much. We knew that things were already going to, you know, be difficult for them. But now our superintendent, his primary concern through the whole beginning of this process was to make sure that we were not giving undue stress to students. Our area, we have a lot of students being raised by grandparents, some being raised by great-grandparents. So this process, especially for the little ones, of trying to be able to send home work that, you know, a parent, let alone a grandparent or a great-grandparent, could really wrap their minds around and understand enough to be able to help them. I mean, that was a huge hurdle.
You teach high school students, and we've talked to some elementary teachers, but the needs of high school students are a lot different. So describe some of the situations and some of the challenges that the families of your students and their families faced.
Yes, and any high school teacher will understand this completely. When those kids get big and they look more like grown-ups than they look like little kids, people start to not be as concerned about their needs, you know, their physical needs for, you know, food and shelter and things like that. And they, for these, some of these families who are, you know, and more, you know, our economically, we struggle. Our entire county is free and reduced right now because, you know, we struggle so bad economically.
You mean they qualify for free and reduced lunch,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the entire county did because we had so many. So these situations, you know, for these families, you know, when COVID hit, many of these families lost their, you know, primary income givers. When I was calling home to my homeroom students, I came across one student whose parent had lost their job because of COVID, and they had a bunch of little kids at the house. And they had no income. And this parent broke down, you know, I mean, and expressed to me that they didn't know what they were going to do, you know. So these real situations, you know, I mean, of course, as educators, our primary goal is to get them educated. But you have to educate the whole child. You know, I mean, you cannot teach a child how to read and how to do math if they don't have any food in the house. So those were the issues that we were really kind of tackling before we were worried about instruction. That was the reason for touching base with all of these students. And those are the questions that we were asked to ask them. Do you have food in the home? What do you need? Do you have electricity? You know, what can we do to help you? And so that in particular parent, those were the questions that I asked, and I got answers that just floored me. So we got this individual some help, got their family help. So our county functions a little different than some counties. We have a really interconnected system, and it's all word of mouth. You know, the churches are interconnected with people in the school, and they're interconnected with social services. And so we pulled on all of those resources to get food out to kids and to help people keep their bills afloat, you know, so that they could then worry about the instruction of their children.
And you made a good point that a lot of families didn't have time to think about students' schoolwork because they were struggling to find a job or support the family when they'd lost their job. And high school students can work. They can go out and get jobs. And I think you said you had some students that had a hard time doing schoolwork because they began working full time.
Yes, I had some that went and got public jobs. You know, I had one that was working in a local automotive place, and other children who were working in fast food. And then I had some of my students that were cutting wood and selling wood and, you know, doing things that they were just really, truly trying to scrape by. So they, you know, I'd contact them and they would say, oh, Ms. Robinson, I'm so sorry. I don't have my NTI work. I worked at my job until 11 o'clock last night. I was so tired. I just crashed, you know, and I'm like, you know, what do you say to those students? They have to work to help out with the family. I mean, you know, I would just tell them, you know, well, don't worry about some of it. Maybe when you can, read a book, you know, I mean, just trying to encourage them to keep some of those basic skills going that I knew that they would need.
You know, we don't think about high school students being thrilled to see their teachers, but I think you shared a story about a student that was isolated and was pretty happy to see you.
Yes. I had a student, and this student had lost a parent last year during the school year. And this child would come to me frequently, and I worried and worried over this baby. And this individual was on my homeroom calling list. And so I called the student, and I couldn't get a hold of the student. And I tried multiple ways. I actually reached out to the student's friends as well to try to get them to contact this person for me. And I finally, you know, and as teachers, we're always taught, not to engage in students on social media, you know, because it's dangerous. I reached out to this child over Facebook because I didn't know how else to get a hold of her. And so I eventually just really started to worry. And so our youth services director, I pestered him a few times, and he's so busy. You know, I mean, they're so busy right now trying to help students, but he made the time to go and do a home visit. And he took pictures of this baby so that I could see that this student was okay. And then, of course, she emailed me later and messaged me later and said, I'm so sorry. You know, I just was kind of tuned out.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I mean, so, you know, you have ones that you worry, you know, about so much. And then you have some, like another student of mine, that he would email me every day. And he wasn't my homeroom student. He was one of my regular students. And he would tell me what he was doing. You know, I mean, he was in his home, you know, with his ailing grandmother, and they live in town, and he had nothing to do. He couldn't go anywhere, and he just felt super isolated. And so I would, you know, while I was throughout the day doing this and that, I would take time to stop and email him every time he emailed me so he could have that contact. But they miss school. They miss school a lot.
Yeah, I think we assume high school students don't want to be at school, but I think a lot of us and the students learned that they did, in fact.
Yes. Yes, I've had many that I've seen, you know, out in the community, and they'll stop and, you know, we're supposed to socially distance. And I've had some bum rush me in parking lots and grab a hold of me and hug me and say, I miss you so much, you know, and you just realize how very important that is to them, because, you know, that a lot of them, they're older children. And so they get left at home alone when parents work, and they, in that way, they feel more isolated, I think, than the little kids do.
Yeah, I think so. So a lot of things are uncertain about the fall. I think you already mentioned that Rockcastle County is preparing for the worst and preparing the non-traditional lessons. But what do you anticipate your job's going to be like this fall? How's it going to be the same, or how's it going to be different?
Well, we've gotten a barrage of different information, of course. Our new superintendent, Carrie Ballinger, she's a very organized person and has done a fantastic job of really kind of taking the lead on this and, you know, and starting to prepare for every scenario possible that we could think of. The district has taken the governor's emergency relief funds that the schools were given, and we have bought Chromebooks for all of the students from 4th to 12th grade. And we're going to have to figure out how to get some of those students internet, you know, because some of them live in places where they can't get internet. And that's going to be an issue we'll have to tackle. And I've not really heard how we're going to do that. And her goal and the district's goal is to have as many students in class as we can at the beginning of the year, because they really need that. They're going to suffer a lag in their learning from the time that we've been off, and then coupled with the summertime gap as well. So I've heard different things. They're rearranging the classrooms so that students have distance from each other. There was some talk of keeping students more stationary and moving teachers around. So, you know, there's a possibility that we're going to have to be working mobily and moving from room to room. And there's definitely some preparation is going to go into play for us to be able to teach digitally. And so that's been something that we've all been having to deal with, doing meetings and everything digitally. But there's a lot of programs out there that are offered. I just recently checked into a program called Loom, where you can lecture, and it's pretty interactive. So kind of looking towards professional development over the summer to get us in gear to be able to teach however we need to teach.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed that we're able to do that with our students.
Yes, definitely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Holly.
Well, thank you.
Coming up after the break, the right of an American woman to vote year 100 and AmeriCorps jobs for the taking. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson, Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The 19th Amendment, establishing the right of women to vote, was ratified 100 years ago. Now, a century later, we're looking into the many ways this pivotal moment in American history has, or has not, changed our society and its governance. Here with this month's chapter in our ongoing series is EKU Professor of History, Jackie Jay.
As we've seen throughout this series, the experiences of women fighting for the right to vote differed greatly depending on where they were in the country and what race they were. Back in March, I talked with Sarah Egge of Centre College about the situation in the Midwest, and we learned just how much of an issue the voting rights of immigrants from Germany became in states like South Dakota. In the past few months, my co-host Kathy Kern has explored the experiences of Black Americans with a number of her colleagues from the University of Kentucky. Today, I'm here with Dr. Melanie Gowen to talk about the struggle as it developed here in Kentucky. Dr. Gowen is associate professor in the University of Kentucky Department of History, and her book, A Simple Justice, Kentucky Women Fight for the Vote, will be published this fall. Congratulations and welcome to the series, Melanie.
Thanks, Jackie. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, so I'll start by asking you, what's distinctive about the situation in Kentucky? What made it different from the fight for women's suffrage elsewhere in the country?
Well, I'm guessing for a lot of folks, for me included, before I really dug into studying the situation in Kentucky, Kentucky's not the first place that comes to mind when we think about the fight for the vote. We might think about New York and Seneca Falls, or maybe Wyoming, where women got the right to vote first, or Tennessee, where the battle ended, but usually not Kentucky. So Kentucky it presents its own set of circumstances, and what we see is in the South, suffrage took off more slowly than it did in other parts of the country. And I mentioned the West. A lot of the early victories in the Western states, a lot of the organizing went on in the Northeast, and the South had really lagged behind, presenting barriers for woman suffrage to take hold, and probably people can reason out why that was so. If you know anything about the South, you might understand that patriarchy was really entrenched in that area. Women tended to be held up on a pedestal, and it seemed the natural order of things for men to make decisions for women. Also in the South, you had strong biblical faith, a Christian faith that caused people to look at the injunctions, for instance, from the Apostle Paul that women were to keep silent. And so Southerners had a natural aversion, it seemed, to considering expanding the roles of women. And in the South, most importantly, enfranchising women threatened the racial order. The 15th Amendment, following on the heels of the Civil War, had enfranchised African American men, but Southerners really resented this. They viewed this as a supreme indignity. It was federal intrusion. In white Southerners' minds, to consider woman suffrage was to endorse the 15th Amendment and to threaten all that held dear. It would reopen some of these big questions. And they also tended to see suffrage as a Yankee invention, something that the Northerners were trying to force on them.
Many argued that the women of their region were perfectly happy the way things were. And we saw last time, back in March, you talked with Sarah Egge, and she talked about the circumstances that influenced suffrage's expansion in the Midwest. Here in the South, we see a similar set of unique challenges when it came to this question of expanding the franchise. But for national leaders, suffrage leaders who looked at ensuring the success of this movement, they knew they needed to expand it to all regions of the country. And so they had to get the South on board. And that's why a border state like Kentucky proved to be so important. Leaders believed that you had to have states like Kentucky kind of open the door for other southern states to follow.
And many of our listeners will know of key Kentucky figures like Laura Clay and Madeline Breckinridge. And so how do they develop against that backdrop that you've described? How do they come to be in a state like Kentucky?
Well, Kentucky came to national leaders' attention for several reasons. And part of it was the leadership that the state produced. You mentioned Laura Clay and Madeline McDowell Breckinridge. But Kentucky, in other ways, too, was on national leaders' radar screens. For one thing, it was Southern, but it wasn't too Southern. It had never seceded during the Civil War. It had a smaller black population, which meant that some of these concerns of race and how that influenced the expansion of suffrage, that was less pronounced in a place like Kentucky. Kentucky also was held up as kind of a beacon of enlightenment in certain ways, as one of the first places in the country to enfranchise women. And very few people know this, but Kentucky women, some very few Kentucky women, were voting as early as 1838. And they were doing so in just certain elections, school elections, and that might make some sense. As guardians of the home, guardians of the children, the state, when it created its common school system, enfranchised women who were widows, who were known as femsole, who were single women, and who paid taxes, they could vote in school elections. And so national leaders, when they looked for inroads to the South, Kentucky seemed to be a place that had potential for opening those doors. One leader called it one single point of light. That's what Kentucky seemed to offer. And so these national leaders, they looked for how to begin that process of bringing the South on board. And you had some individuals within the state that stepped forward to open these doors. And the Clay family there, incredibly important in Kentucky in terms of woman suffrage, but also on a national basis as well. And you mentioned Laura Clay. Actually, it wasn't Laura Clay that first opened these doors. It was her older sister, Mary Barr Clay. And in the mid-1870s, Mary Barr Clay started showing interest in this national movement, a movement that most Kentuckians, if they were aware of it, they tended to shun, again, as a Yankee imposition. But Mary Barr Clay, she starts reading about suffrage. She writes into a national suffrage journal to announce that she was enlisted for the war. And she attended national conventions, invited Susan B. Anthony to visit Kentucky in 1879. And she starts this process, bringing her mother and her sisters on board.
Mm-hmm. I know that suffragists in Kentucky didn't always agree. So what were the major points of conflict? How did that division affect the struggle?
Yes, certainly there are many points of disagreement. And we like to think that certainly these women who are fighting for noble causes were probably all on the same page. We often think about suffrage as just the way history unfolds, a natural progression of events, but it was fiercely fought. And the women who fought those battles often disagreed on strategy. Laura Clay, Mary Barclay's younger sister, she was the one who established the Kentucky Equal Rights Association. She leads the movement for 3 decades. She makes it into a career. And in spite of her progressive desire to see women vote, she's pretty conservative in a lot of other ways. And she really stamps her ideas and her impression on the Kentucky Equal Rights Association.
As a conservative voice, what was that perspective?
Well, Laura Clay wanted to recruit among women that looked a lot like herself and upheld very similar values. She was very much a deeply religious woman, a Christian woman. And so, for instance, CARA, when it holds its annual meetings, they begin each convention with prayer, Bible readings sprinkled throughout the convention. That becomes problematic as the movement grows and as more women are brought into it, Jewish women, for instance. And later leaders, Madeleine McDowell Breckinridge, who becomes president, she's Laura Clay's hand-chosen successor in 1912, she dialed back some of that overt Christianity that Laura Clay had insisted upon.
Madeleine Breckinridge, she was wanting to open up enfranchisement more to other groups beyond just that white Christian narrow sector of society?
Yes, although Madeleine McDowell Breckinridge was a realist, and she recognized that many Kentuckians, white Kentuckians, shared the same priorities as Laura Clay. And so race will be a defining factor in Kentucky's suffrage movement. Even though Kentucky appeared racially progressive to many national leaders, when it came down to it, white Kentuckians tended to still believe that only whites should vote and that expanding the franchise would open the door for African-American women to vote, and that was a dangerous force in their minds.
How did Kentucky get to the point of voting and ratifying on the 19th Amendment?
Women who wanted the vote didn't necessarily agree on the strategies to gain it. We like to think that history is this steady march of progress and that woman suffrage was bound to come, just one more step toward achieving our high American ideals. But it was really a very contentious, messy process. In Kentucky, first of all, we should note that many women didn't want any part of voting, that there was strong anti-suffrage sentiment, especially in Western Kentucky. But even suffragists who could agree on the main goal couldn't always agree on how to achieve it.
So then for the last question in our last few minutes, I'd like to open it up to the bigger picture. Why do you think Kentucky's story matters? Why do you think it should be better known, both by us here in Kentucky and across the country?
Well, Kentucky as a border state was desirable for national leaders. They looked at this as their way to gain support in the South. But what it meant for the larger movement was bartering away its ideals and backtracking on universal equality. And Kentucky, as a place where race was central to the movement, both in its possibilities, what it seemed like the potential to win a southern state where race might not be as detrimental to the cause, but in reality, race was highly relevant here in this state, and the complexities of race in a border state really offer us an opportunity to better understand how race and gender worked together to inhibit women's right to vote.
Thank you. And that, I think, is a remarkable place to end, that once again,
race is so central, and the story in Kentucky has so many lessons that continue to resonate, especially given the situation we're in 2020. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, mm-hmm. Melanie.
Uh-huh.
Each year, a state agency, Serve Kentucky, grants and administers around $6.5 million of AmeriCorps state funding in Kentucky to support such things as tutoring remedial students, providing housing development and repair, environmental education, and a whole lot more. Joe Bryngardner joins us from Frankfort, where he is executive director of Serve Kentucky. Thanks for joining us, Joe.
Hey, great. Thanks for letting me come on call.
And Joe, if you could, just give us the elevator response when somebody asks you, what is Serve Kentucky?
Sure. Serve Kentucky is the organization within the Cabinet for Health and Family Services that oversees all the AmeriCorps programs across Kentucky. You know, AmeriCorps is sort of like a domestic version of the Peace Corps. We have about 1,000 Kentuckians that are dedicating a year of their life to service in the community.
And so tell us about this AmeriCorps funding. How does your office obtain those funds?
We receive funding two different ways throughout the year. There is a national competition where the majority of all of the money that comes from the Corporation for National Community Service is in one pot. And basically every state has a state commission along with the two territories and some of the larger national direct programs. And we all compete for that funding. Kentucky has been very, very successful in this national competition, actually about 7 years running, where virtually every program that we have submitted has been funded. So this past year, we saw the most intense competition to date, and we received funding for nearly every program that we submitted. And then we get a formula funding grant that comes to us in the spring, and the formula funding aligns with the population of the state. So naturally, Kentucky's formula would be quite a bit less than, say, a state like Florida's. But that's funding that we do another assessment of the state with and grant other programs through that funding as well.
Well, this list of grant recipients is pretty significant, and I have to imagine that these funds are especially welcome right now.
Indeed. I think part of the power behind the AmeriCorps National Service is these are local Kentuckians, people in our backyards that are finding a community problem, partnering with us through local initiatives and tackling those problems through service. It's human capital at work. It's neighbor helping neighbor. And we've got a pretty strong match as well, which shows AmeriCorps as this model as a private-public partnership. We wouldn't exist if it weren't for the foundations, the community action centers, the universities that actually partner with that match with us, showing the power of what we can do when we do that PPP.
Joe, I count 22, I believe, recipient organizations or institutions across the state in this year's batch. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you had to pick out some prime examples of how this money is put to work, what would you choose?
Gosh, always the toughest question, and it typically depends on the part of the state because the majority of our programs are regional. We have a few that are statewide, and we have some that are local, but a majority of them do work across the state. A national model program for us would be our Unite Service Corps, which operates down in southeastern Kentucky. We're very proud to be working with Operation Unite with a program that is a tutoring and mentoring program, and it also focuses heavily on drug awareness and drug prevention. And they've been a national leader in that movement well before the opioid crisis exploded. They had curriculum that they're taking to schools and to places all throughout that community, discussing the importance of understanding these kind of crises that come down the pike. What's unique, too, is that a program like that, we see this unique aspect of social entrepreneurism and different outputs that were almost unintended. And they've actually been able to discover some data through that program that aligns math tutoring with building behaviors that could help those stay away from making poor choices like taking drugs. And that's something that was never even intended when the program started many, many years ago. So I'd say that's one of them. One of our largest grantees is Berea College. We've got three tremendous programs operating through Berea all throughout southeastern Kentucky, mostly working in school turnaround and tutoring and mentoring programs. And the impact that those members have in those communities is astronomical. A great example is looking at what we were able to achieve with other partners in Leslie County High School, where just a few years ago, that was a federal takeover school, I should say, one of the worst performing schools in the state. And we had an influx of AmeriCorps members and VISTA volunteers, along with a lot of other great things that the administration and teachers did. And they flipped around that school like you wouldn't believe. And they're doing just amazing work down there in that county. We still have a strong program there.
Well, if somebody hears this and they're inspired by it and they would like to become an AmeriCorps volunteer, what do they need to do? And how do you qualify for that?
Well, any American that wishes to serve their nation for a year at any capacity, actually, can be involved in what we do. The folks in our programs are actual members. They're not volunteers, but we do mobilize volunteers too. So we've got tens and thousands of volunteers. So if you're an average citizen that you're inspired with what's happened the last several months, you want to get out and do a bit more in your community, we can help connect you with one of our AmeriCorps programs as a volunteer, where you might be able to help us work with a senior in need that doesn't have family around, or you may be able to help us and one of our programs where we're mentoring or tutoring kids or possibly working with a veteran or military family. A more profound way, obviously, is to become an actual AmeriCorps member. We think this is vital because this wave of national service right now is pretty tremendous. There's a calling for people that want to do more. Mm-hmm. They want to stand behind something bigger than themselves. Joining AmeriCorps is a way to do that. Our members get a living wage. Our members get health insurance while they're serving, and they get an education award upon their completion of service. So it's a tremendous way to help pay for college or pay off past student loans. So I would say the easiest way to do is to go directly to our Facebook page. That's where we keep the most amount of our data. Serve Kentucky on Facebook, website as well. But on the Facebook page, we can pinpoint you directly to your county. We can show you the kind of programs that we have in AmeriCorps, and or we can help you find potentially a passion point you have in which you may want to serve. You could serve as a full-time member, which is 1,700 hours a year. It's like a full-time job. Many of our members are part-time. They're still in school, so they might only serve 900 hours, or quarter-time, just serving 300 to 400 hours.
Joe Bringardner is Executive Director of Serve Kentucky. Thanks so much for joining us, Joe.
Thank you so much. Take good care.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.